All right, good morning, everyone. I could say you look like people who need ethics credits, but you look much more accomplished. Welcome to the Generative AI and the Restructuring Professional presentation. We have a pretty accomplished set of panelists to my left today, and you've got their biographies or even some reduced format, minimized, of them and their accomplishments. But I also wanted to give you some fun fact about each of our speakers today. So with Kareem Gerges of ABI, today is his birthday. He's spending it with us, not his family.
Happy birthday, Kareem.
All right. We have
22.
Okay.
That's in AI years.
Yes. I should use that. And then we have Frank Pometti from Alex Partners. So here's a fun, really wonderful fact. He says, restructuring advisors always say we are prepared to quickly parachute into a distressed situation. When serving as a military intelligence officer in the U.S. Army earlier in his career, Frank actually earned his airborne wings for parachuting out of airplanes, so he is prepared to literally parachute in if the situation calls for it. And thank you for your service, Frank. And then we have Lisa van de Steek from Levenfeld Perlstein. So you've known her as sort of being Miss ABI. She speaks at many conferences, was the co-chair last year. But here's a fun fact about her. She's an avid scuba diver. She's been scuba certified for over 25 years and has logged nearly 200 dives.
Wait, I didn't know that about you. That's
it's a long-standing thing. I don't know how you don't know that about me.
Oh my God. We got it. We have to talk.
All right. So I, after listening to the mock confirmation hearing yesterday, I thought I have range anxiety, particularly in the moment with my limited mobility. But I don't know if that's a fun fact. One fact that maybe not a lot of people know is that I started law school on the day my daughter started kindergarten. She finished first, but we did our homework together. So those are the fun facts. I'm going to start by talking about a few cases where AI-generated material has been used to the displeasure of the court, maybe the parties, other parties. And also tell you about a few courts that have some local rules about either prohibiting use of AI-generated material, there are a few of those, or conditioning what may be submitted to the court using that kind of material. So I know we all recognize that judges do their own research on cases presented, right? But they are guided by what the parties present. So if it's gravely incorrect, that is not helpful. There are a couple cases from 2023 I thought I'd just mention. Ruggiero Velardo versus Lancaster. And there the defendant was pro se. And as the court said, he cited a mutant citation, meaning it was a blend of Michigan and Fifth Circuit case references. And he also cited two non-existent cases in his submissions. And the court said, you know, that kind of faulty submission just wastes the court's time. It wastes resources of the other party who has to respond. But it was a pro se party, and so in that case, the judge just warned there could be sanctions if this happens again. Another 2023 case out of the Southern District of New York might be more familiar to you, Mata versus Avianca. And there, in opposing a motion to dismiss. A plaintiff filed a declaration which included non-existent case sites as well as fake quotations. So that's sort of making it more egregious, I think. And in light of that, the court set a hearing order to show cause why sanctions shouldn't be imposed for abusing the adversary system. And we could sort of say the smoke of generative AI material, do we stop, drop, and roll? But the sort of motto that this court used was stop, think, and investigate. If you're going to use material, you use generative AI material, you still have some duty yourself. And Rule 11 is really what courts cite primarily. The judge, I think, was very careful in this Mata case and said, of course, it's any sanction has to be commensurate with the offense, and courts are very careful in not over-sanctioning. But here, this conscious avoidance of not checking the authorities by counsel, the court felt was bad faith. And so between, I think, the individual lawyer and the firm, there was a $5,000 sanction. It seems as if that could have been larger, except the court acknowledged that since discovering this error, the firm had instituted training for its lawyers on if you're going to use these the software availability, you still have your own duties to investigate and check. I'll give you one more case, a little more recent. January of this year from the District of Minnesota, Coles versus Ellison. So the plaintiff had filed a motion to exclude expert witness declarations filed by the state of Minnesota in support of a motion for a preliminary injunction. The case challenged the Minnesota statute, which prohibits deepfakes, which intend to injure a political candidate. And one of the declarations that the plaintiffs sought to preclude was from a professor of communication at Stanford, who also was director of Stanford's social media lab. And his declaration included citations to two non-existent articles on this topic. He admitted that that's what those were, in fact. And counsel for the state, the attorney general, asked the court if his expert could submit an amended declaration saying this was just excusable neglect. Well, what do you think? Court starts out its discussion of this particular request by saying the irony, where you have, I'm quoting now, the professor, a credentialed expert on the dangers of AI and misinformation, has fallen victim to the siren call of relying too heavily on AI. The court acknowledged at the preliminary injunction stage it's not a Daubert-level inquiry in what experts have submitted, but it's still, Rule 11 still applies, and material that's filed has to be validated for truth and legal reasonableness. And so the request to amend the declaration, file an amended declaration, was denied, which I think put a dent in the state's case. Okay. Then, I mentioned some courts have developed rules that go beyond Rule 11. And I think some courts that don't have specific rules think, you know, just the text of Rule 11 covers what could be misuse of AI-generated material, but others want to go farther. So a couple I found prohibited. Look, nearby, Northern District of Illinois, Judge Coleman As a rule, parties may not use AI to draft their memoranda or as authority to support their motions. That's pretty clear. A couple of judges from Northern and Southern Districts of Ohio have this rule: when preparing a filing to be submitted to the court, no AI may be used except for information gathered from legal search engines, Westlaw, Lexis, or internet search engines, Google or Bing. Lawyers have a duty to inform the court of prohibited AI usage, and violators may face sanctions. So they're just not ready to have it there. Maybe based on some of those cases I described a moment ago. And then a few other courts I found, they will allow it, but they have some conditions. Also in the Northern District of Illinois, Judge Johnston, if using AI, the submission must comply with Rule 11B and 26G and any other relevant rule, including applicable ethics rules. The filer, the lawyer, must certify review of the source materials and accuracy with each filing. So there is that step of certifying. Southern District of New York Bankruptcy Court has a local rule. Litigants remain responsible for the accuracy and quality of legal documents produced with the assistance of technology such as ChatGPT, Google Bard, etc., or generative AI services. Litigants are cautioned that certain technologies may produce factually or legally inaccurate content. If a litigant chooses to employ technology, the litigant continues to be bound by the requirements of Rule 9011 and must review and verify. To me, that seems to be something less than certify to the court. You're just taking the step of verifying any such content to ensure it complies with such standards. Bankruptcy Court in the Western District of Oklahoma requires an attestation to 3 points: identify the generative AI program used and for which parts of the text. So this is getting to be quite a task. Certify the document was checked for accuracy using print reporters or other reliable means, and then certify that use of the program has not resulted in the disclosure of any confidential information to any unauthorized party. So those are just some examples, and they differ. So it just kind of underscores what is a question, I think, in almost any litigation program is know your audience, know your local rules, and don't assume, because you read a recent case, that you know what that court expects. But there may be particular rules. Okay.
So we'll dive into some ethics. And I kind of can't believe that we still are seeing courts having to tell attorneys don't submit flat out content generated by AI. Nonetheless, it's where we are, so be smart. Don't do that. However, what we really want to provide to you today are some tips of ways that you can, and dare I say, should be incorporating the use of AI into your practice. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. But in order for us to do that, in order for us to give you guys some good practical ways to use it, we do have to go through the I think it's fun, you might think it's painful exercise of understanding for lawyers what the ethical parameters are, because they're out there and they should be relatively common sense. So part of your materials was ABA's formal opinion 512, came down last summer, and it provides guidance as to the general landscape of your ethical obligations with respect to the use of Gen AI. Strongly recommend that you give it a read. It's not very long and is a super helpful framework. But let's just provide a quick summary of what those ethical guidelines are before we dive into how you can be using these tools well. So first rule in play, of course, as you would expect, is 1.1. It's our duty of competence. We have to be aware, and comment 8 on this hasn't changed since 2012. We have to know what the relevant technologies are. We have to be able to assess risks and benefits associated with the use of them in order to be able to competently represent our clients, in order to be able to competently take on an engagement. With respect to AI, what does that mean? Does that mean that we all have to be an expert in the actual tool? No. But we need to understand what the options are. We need to understand if there is a specific legal tool that could provide efficiencies. We need to understand if we're going to use them, what's the proper use of them? How are we making sure that we know how to prompt these tools? How are we making sure that we know how to validate the output so that we can use them in an ethical and responsible manner and take advantage of some of the efficiencies that they can provide to us? Pass along some of those cost-saving, time-saving benefits to our clients. 1.1. We also have 1.6. Oh, I might be going out of order of my PowerPoint. No, we can go back to 1.4. We'll go in numerical order. 1.4 is our duty to communicate with our clients. This one is implicated in a number of different ways. Here's one to think about. Do you have a client who either requires you to use some of these new tools or wants to tell you you can't use those? Well, you need to have a conversation with your client about it. You need to have the knowledge with respect to what those different options are, and again, the risks and benefits, so that you can have a discussion with your client. If you have a client come to you and tell you, I don't want you using any AI in connection with this engagement, is that even feasible? And I'm not even talking Gen AI, because we talk a lot about Gen AI in terms of something that creates content, but if we're just talking AI more broadly, well, there's a lot of artificial intelligence baked into all of the tools we use on a day-to-day basis. Word, your Outlook. So make sure that you understand that and you can have that conversation intelligently with your client. Make sure that if you want to use a tool that would really dive into, let's say you're doing a big doc review and you want to use an adaptive review to be able to cut through that more quickly, you should probably have a conversation with your client to make sure that they understand what you're using it for and they agree to it. So again, we have a duty to communicate with our clients about this. Now, does this mean that we have to go to our clients with every little use of AI? No. No, it does not. If we're going to use AI to create an outline of talking points for things that we might want to use that does not implicate a client's confidential information, I don't think we need to worry about calling them up and making sure they're okay that we used AI to create an outline. But if we're going to be using a tool that is going to have a material impact on a decision that client is going to make on a particular strategy, those are the ones that we need to be thoughtful about disclosing and discussing with our clients. Moving on to rule 1.6, confidentiality. Please. Oh, and please, if people have questions, thank you, Judge Harwood, raise them as we go. Sure. It's inevitable. And I think it's also inevitable that we will start to get drafts of AI-generated content from our clients to say, hey, I already put this together. Maybe all they need from us then is the actual legal review of the document they already think is close to good enough, right? It's going to happen. It has happened already.
So I want to interject a little bit on Rule 1.1. And I know this talks about this ethical rule for lawyers, but the question is, does the court have to abide by that rule as well? Do judges need to have that legal research or duty of competency in legal technology so they are aware of what are lawyers using when they present cases and briefs in front of them? I don't know if the court is held to that same standard, especially when the AO position on AI is don't use it. So that question is probably to the judge.
Yeah, really, thanks for that, Corinne. my answer is I don't know. I think with more of these, there's a greater familiarity with the cases where there have been problems, right? Certainly, I think there are discussions within most courts, even if they don't have a formal local rule, they're talking about this is out there. They're talking about it certainly more in the sense of what's being filed, not what the court itself is issuing. I think I started by saying judges do their own research. They do. And I think I've had a few conversations maybe with people who have tested what they wrote with an AI utility, but what they've issued is their own work, and that's what I know at this point.
Yeah. I mean, there's a big distinction between the generative AI and just the simplicity of using AI tools. So AI doesn't necessarily have to generate fake information and I'm not talking about hallucination. I'm talking about just like create something that didn't exist before. A summary of a brief that's grounded in truth based on that brief that you just read, that is considered generative AI. But in reality, it's just summarizing something that already exists. We've had these tools before the GPT ever existed. There were tons of algorithmic tools before that summarized, a notion, summarized articles and things like that. It came very famous online with the TLDR, too long, didn't read. I don't know how many of you had some of these applications where you'd add it to your Chrome extension and you come against a Wall Street Journal article that's about, 12 pages long, and you click that little TLDR and it'll just give you a summary exactly of what that is. That was prior to the GPT. This was something happening in, 2012, 2013 and on. So these tools summarize the existing of the content based on the context of what's have it. It's not generating something new. It's just extracting information from that. To the extent that people are using AI tools for stuff like that, I don't know if that would be considered, generative AI, at least in the sense of what we believe generative AI is. And then on the confidentiality, it's really interesting because I had this discussion with a few CIOs at law firms, and it's a big question. Because you're supposed to take all your materials that you get from individual clients and kind of isolate them from each other. They're kind of like firewalled. Mm-hmm. Well, law firms who want to build an AI model internally for themselves technically cannot share this content from one client to the next. Well, then how is the AI model learning anything if it's not sharing information between clients? And then the way around that, or at least some people have made their way around that, is that the client has rights to their own content, but they do not have rights to the content produced by the firm on their own behalf. And that content belongs to the firm. Hence, they can give that content to the AI model and train their model based on what they've given it. Now, the interesting part is there are some clients who will come in and say, not only you are not allowed to use AI, but you're also not allowed to use AI to generate any content. And if you do generate any content that's driven from what I've given you access to my information, that is privileged information, even if it's your work product, and we do not want you to train your model on it. And I don't know how those legal conversations will take place in law firms, but it will probably be a very interesting.
It's super complicated, and here's a really fun blurring of rules 1.6 and 1.1, right? So Kareem's bringing up a whole bunch of really technical issues around how can these tools be used without running afoul of confidentiality or privilege issues. does every person in this room need to be able to answer that question? No, but do they need to know it exists, and do they need to have competent tech professionals that they can consult with to understand the different limitations of these different tools as your firm is considering which tools do we as an organization want to use? Which ones are appropriate for the practice of law and which ones may not be? So it's certainly something that my firm has undergone in terms of building out our AI best use practices and policies. And it's something that our task force has been in constant communication with our chief technology officer on, because he's laser focused on how do we make sure that we are selecting and implementing and training on the tools that we believe can be used in the safest manner possible to make sure that we are abiding by issues related to privilege and confidentiality. So that brings us in then to also rules 5.1 and 5.3, duty of supervision, both of lawyers and non-lawyers. We're responsible. The partnership is responsible for not only ourselves understanding, but making sure that those who we manage and supervise are also understanding what acceptable ethical use is of these tools, make sure that we're providing training to people on them before we just allow them to use them. And as we're vetting our third-party vendors, make sure that we have competent people who can understand to review the different policies, the different terms of use of whatever tools we may want to implement, so that we are, again, abiding by our own ethical obligations as we are using, rolling out, training people on the use of different AI tools.
So that means old people have to know about this, right?
Yes. Much like 20 years ago, we had to have conversations about email. And then 10 years ago, we had to talk more and more about online research. This is just one more tool as technology evolves that we will have to figure out how to roll out across our industry, because it's not going to go away. It's simply going to continue to expand into so many other different pockets that we got to figure out how can we use it? How can we make sure we understand it? How do we make sure that we talk a lot about, is AI going to replace us? No. Might it replace certain functions or tasks that are more routine, that can be done more effectively by an AI tool? Yeah, for sure. But so we need to figure out then how we are training up the next gen on the ability to use those tools and make sure that we then, in that supervisory managerial capacity, know how to train them on that and be sure that we know how to review the new output that we are getting from them generated by AI so that we can make sure that we're using it appropriately.
I also believe that there has to be a mind shift when we talk about training. I mean, this is just like every technology. The only difference is that models are being updated every 2 weeks. They're completely changing every 2 weeks because there's so many competition and there's so much research that's taking place. So they're improving at a much, much faster pace than any other technology out there. And adoption forces that as well. So by doing one class on AI in January and expecting that the same result of that or the same training that you've done in January for the firm is going to last for the entire year or cover everything that happens in that year, only if you don't adapt the new models that come up and refuse to update your tools. But if you are using something like any of the public available tools, those tools are being updated on a constant basis, and that model will probably change 3 or 4 times, if not more, within that year. So the things that you've taught people on in January probably will be obsolete by March. So that's a big difference in a mind shift. The other thing, which I always say, for now at least, AI, when it comes to lawyers, AI is coming to remove the robot work out of the lawyer's work. There's a lot of robotic things. There's a lot of repetitive tasks that most lawyers have to do, which I think AI would be very, very efficient in doing those type of works. You don't need to sit down and rewrite, you know, your I don't know, 200 brief, where most of them are basically copy and paste, and a lot of law firms, large firms, have templates for these, right? So today, those are the things that most of your time is spent on. If 60, 70% of your time would be, if not your time, but some time, somebody's time, associate time, is substituted by tools that can augment their ability to get to that work much faster, much quicker, then that leaves a lot of time for you to actually do the real work where the clients is paying you to come up with a strategy to win that case, figure out exactly where the arguments need to be made that have not been made before. The other part, which I love, because I'm going to take this from Professor Nancy Rappaport, when she made a comment in April. She's like, I don't understand why people expect that when you use AI, it has to be 100% accurate. And I kind of shouted and like said, hello, yes, finally. somehow, as soon as we use computers, we expect it to be perfect. But nothing we do is ever perfect. Even if you worked on it, no matter how experienced you are as a lawyer in a case, if you have more time, you probably will produce better product. So ultimately, the same concept applies. If I'm going to give this task or this work, whether it's research or other, to a few associates in my firm, I don't expect that the product that they're going to give me is 100% accurate. I will have to review it. So to the same extent that if we actually use AI, expecting that it's not going to be perfect, that I do have to review it, then, you know, that problem with hallucination and things like that will go away. And then actually, like, the logical argument that the AI is making within that research will also go away, because you're prompting it, you're asking it questions, it giving you back answers, and you're working with it to give you that. I'm not saying that substitute associates work, but I'm just saying that you should actually push your associates to do that kind of work so they become a lot more efficient. I think that's probably the way that needs to move forward. The problem, I've always said that, is that firms are not built that way from fee structure.
And no, but they might have to change.
Yeah, until they figure out a way, you know, to change how the business is being handled and how they can bill for their work. And there's a lot of conversations taking place right now on that topic. But it's inevitable. It's only a matter of time where it's going to come, where people are going to have to question, why does this task take so long when there's a tool that can do it for, you know, a quarter of the time? And the reality is, these tools are not, you know, private in any way. They're available to your clients as well. Any firm who has a general counsel has access to most of these tools, and they'll probably question when they come to a bankruptcy firm and saying, why this is taking so long when I can do this on my own Westlaw or my own LexisNexis tool in a half the time.
So we promised you guys more interactive, demonstrative. And it's not just law firms. It's also our financial advisory friends. And so fortunately for us, we've got Frank here to give us some real-time, well, great content about how we're using it, how our restructuring professionals are using this, in particular on the financial advisory. So I'd love to see this. We are going to have a few transition moments as we are plugging in various computers into the big screens, so bear with us, and if there are any questions to shout out as we're in transition, feel free.
And I'll give you a quote I read when I was doing some research in law school, and this judicial opinion said, the law follows technology limping. And I think part of this program is to help lawyers not limp, right, and get through some of the proper use of these new technologies.
Yeah, it's connected. Yep. Great. Well, thank you, Lisa. So again, not a lawyer, but hear from the financial advisory side and really share a bit how, you know, we, and especially at Alex Partners, how we're trying to approach Gen AI. And first, discuss a kind of tool, a proprietary tool. Yeah, there are a lot of third-party enterprise tools out there. We've developed our own proprietary platform based on Gen AI. Talk a bit about that. Have a few brief demo videos. I wish I could do a real robust live demo, but we have a few videos just to give a flavor for the capabilities of the tool, and then talk through areas on how we're looking to apply it to the restructuring process. So I do want to put out the disclaimer. Not only am I not a lawyer, I'm not a coder or developer, so very, very technical questions on our tool I can't get into. So it's more about the capabilities and how we're trying to apply it. Just from a broad overview, you know, we've developed a platform. It's called Didi. I really don't know the genesis of the name, but it's called Didi. And, you know, when we're developing it, it's all about how do we provide our services, do our work faster, more efficient, and increase the scope of it. I think Lisa referenced, you know, on a race times hours basis, you know, when you're involved in a distress situation, it can be expensive. The more efficient we are, the more that inures to the benefit of our clients. So we want to keep kind of the hours down and try to provide those services as efficiently as possible. There are a lot of tools out there. You know, Copilot, ChatGPT Enterprise, Perplexity. So, you know, why develop our own? First, you know, by developing our own, we really thought we could tailor it and make it bespoke to our needs. It affords us more flexibility to provide enhancements and kind of upgrades to it than you would if you're using an enterprise solution. And we actually ran a lot of like-for-like tests comparing, you know, our platform against others, and it proved to be a bit more reliable, a bit more accurate, and we, you know, comments were made about kind of having that reference point to really go to the underlying source and where it's kind of providing this output to kind of test and validate everything it's providing us. It provides a bit more confidence there as well. So in the background, this is, again, obviously doing kind of OCR, tagging data, et cetera. It's using some of the best models out there that are constantly developed and changing. If I flip to the next slide, I'll give a quick overview of some of the capabilities of it, show a brief demo video, then really jump into, okay, how are we exploring applying this to the restructuring process? There's really kind of three broad capabilities that, you know, the tool has. You know, similar to typical ChatGPT type tools, you could chat with your data, query it. It could look at a given file, a folder with multiple files or data set, but it's just saving hours from scrolling through files individually, and again, provide that easy reference to hopefully reduce the risk of hallucinations. It's designed to provide custom analysis, so produce kind of analysis, especially when you're looking at financial data or data sets and visualizations, bring some efficiencies in terms of how we present to our clients. But it also provides the flexibility to pull from multiple data sources, whether it's a VDR with just thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of client files to kind of focus on. It could be proprietary internal databases we may have at Alex Partners, but also third-party sources, whether it's the internet or connecting to CapIQ, et cetera. And lastly, this was designed and embedded with review as our expertise. So it is kind of leveraging some of our proprietary tools and processes within DD. So without further ado, I will show a very brief video, and then I'll talk a bit more on how we're trying to apply this more specifically to some of the restructuring.
DD is based on RAG, Retrieval Augmented Generation, a cornerstone capability that we believe unlocks enormous potential in client delivery. It's also built API first, allowing it to serve an ever-growing number of use cases. DD is the place that we design agents that codify the AP way of doing things. Now, let's dive into some of the foundational features of DD, specifically its data sources, its connections, and how they work. DD plugs into your VDR, your virtual data room. It allows us to ingest enormous volumes of data, enterprise scale, tens of thousands of files, hundreds of gigabytes. We've done this in numerous client examples. Here you can see all the files that were uploaded. Let's take a look at one of them. This is a stock purchase agreement. So what does DD do when you ingest files? Behind the scenes, it runs OCR, optical character recognition. It converts images into text. It summarizes the document. It auto-tags it. And it also extracts tables from the documents that later help in the retrieval in retrieval augmented generation. Now let's take a look at DD's marquee feature, chat. Behind the scenes, DD uses GPT-4o and O3 Mini. It can answer questions across Excels, PDFs, PowerPoints, and documents. GenAI is known to hallucinate, so we've made it easy to always check your results and validate the answers. So let's take a look. And as you can see, DD got it right.
So again, that's just a generic tool. So, you know, how are we trying to actually apply this as restructuring advisors? You know, there's kind of three broad areas. There's a lot of areas that we're kind of looking at. You know, just three to call out today. Obviously, first day motions. You know, there's you think about the just the chat capability, querying large data sets. It really becomes evident how when we're working with our restructuring council partners, any first day motions, there's a lot of data sets, metrics that we're trying to pull together with the company by leveraging a tool like this. And you could use something like the wages motion as an example. You got to know, you know, when employment contracts exist, you know, what's the average compensation by pay period, maybe by employee type, et cetera. You know, clients can just dump into a data room just payroll run, you know, extracts. They could just all their policies, all their contracts, and just with a few queries, you could quickly get to some of those answers a lot quicker. Again, all referenced and validated to, you know, kind of speed up that process. And again, the more we could, I think Kareem referred to it as robotic or less value add activity, the more you could minimize that and get to the answer quicker, the more you could focus on the value add. Vendor categorization is one particular area that we're rolling out now. We have a module within DD on that. Again, when, in all bankruptcy situations, we're, whether it's a creditor matrix, parties of interest, but again, when you're looking at first day motions, you could talk about the utility motion. It never ceases to amaze me how poor some of the data within a company is and how they're categorizing their vendors, et cetera. So as much as you think they could just provide who are all your utility vendors, it often requires us to then go into their AP files and really do a scrub. Using a tool like DD, and this leverages some of our experience beyond restructuring and procurement, et cetera, you could then have a trained model that all you need is the vendor name, maybe city, state, and, you know, leveraging that tool, you could ingest that into DD, and it could quickly categorize them far more accurately. And we've done this in client situations where we know what the answer is, and then let's replicate it. And not only is it, you know, a matter of minutes versus maybe a matter of tens of hours or days, the accuracy, and it's interesting when Kareem talked about maybe it doesn't have to be 100% accurate, it not only, you know, had 96, 97% accuracy, it was actually a bit more accurate than the manual process was. So you may not get to perfection, but often you can't always get there. So I was just going to show a brief video that's more specific to the vendor categorization aspect before I end with cash forecasting.
So this is the vendor mapping. And what you would do here is you could upload your vendor list. You browse to the location where you keep it, for example here, and then you would upload it into DD. It just uploads it there, and then you'd run it. I am going to show one that I've done earlier. And one of the things you can click on here in DD is you can ask it to use our own taxonomy, and also you can add it the web search. So you can go ask DD to go out to the web and pull information about these vendors that exist on the internet to help with that mapping. And so that's what DD's done here. And so if I show you what it would have started out as, it started out as this list of the vendors, and then DD can produce it. Either you can look in the app itself, or you can have a look in the Excel, get it downloaded into Excel, You can see here, it'll say, okay, this is FedEx. This is what it's known as, the description come from the internet. These are the C and D is the categorization that it's done, and it's giving you some reasoning here as well in column F. And it does this for all of, and then it returns this file to you. I might pause actually, Mateo. Oh.
So I have to cut him short, given time. One other area where we're focused on now is cash forecasting as financial advisors. Every situation, whether it's in court or out court, out of court, tends to involve an aspect of cash forecasting, managing liquidity. Clients typically do not have a direct cash flow forecast, or if they do, it's not nearly as granular enough as you need. It's a time-intensive process creating that. So for us, the more we could make that a more efficient process, the more value we could add to our clients. So we're now testing how to use this tool, take actual historical disbursement data, bank reconciliation data, you name it, ingest it into DD, and actually integrated with the vendor categorization aspect as well, generate a backwards-looking 13-week cash flow forecast based on actual receipts and disbursements, based on the historical data, which serves as the baseline for them projecting forward, and it really makes that kind of process far more efficient.
Do you create dashboards also that you can monitor not only past performance, but model possible future performance as well, almost like a Monte Carlo probability analysis, things of that sort, try to almost like game model?
So we do actually have a separate tool that's, geared more for that kind of dashboard tracking performance and kind of forward looking. We're looking on how to enhance that, with AI, and how can we ingest, macroeconomic data, et cetera, things like that into the model to, give you more confidence in some of those scenarios, et cetera. So from an AI standpoint, is things we're looking at, but we do have a separate tool that is more focused on that. And then the last area I'll talk about is claims reconciliation. Obviously, matching claims to actual invoices, et cetera. We're exploring another area that's ripe for how could we use GenAI to just make that more efficient. Again, reduce the queue and the price times quantity aspect, so we're providing these services far more efficiently, far more cost effectively to our clients and maximizing value. So. Thank you very much.
I think we're going to have another little transition here. Yeah. And by that, I mean I'm going to stand up and go to the podium.
Hey, Kareem, in the meantime, can you pull up on the PowerPoint?
PowerPoint. Yeah.
Okay. Start there, because I just need those two.
I'm standing at a podium now. I love podiums. I love microphones. So what we wanted to give to you here, because in some ways, from my view, the very best way that we can be using Gen AI is generating starter dough, right? Not for writing briefs, not for that type of stuff, because that still scares me a little bit. How can we use it in a good way to save time? And one of the ways where my relationship with AI went from intro to, oh, I love you, is when I got training from my firm on how to actually be prompting AI. How do I give a Gen AI tool the inputs that it needs to give me the output that I actually want and am looking for? Because Gen AI is not Google. We are not just going in doing Boolean searches. We are not just typing in simple questions. So wanted to give you guys a little bit of both some just words as to how to prompt and then a couple demos. With Gen AI, it's kind of like talking to your first-year associate or an intern or maybe a teenager, where you want to be very clear with what you are telling it. Gen AI wants to help. It wants to give you the answers. It wants to give you the output that you're looking for. So just tell it what you want. Be very clear and specific. Use these step-by-step guidelines. Give it examples, if necessary. You can tell it what tone you want. You can tell it that you want to be very crisp and professional. You can tell it that you want to be warm and engaging. Give it the context. Tell it the purpose. Set the stage. Tell it who you're going to be giving the output to, right? Number 7, indicate your audience. If it's going to be lawyers, judges, tell that. You'll get a different output.
Lisa, not to interrupt, but when we were developing some of our tools and we were with some kind of third-party tech firms in, you know, we called it a hackathon, and it really scared me in a way, but it made me laugh. You know, when we weren't getting the answers that we wanted from the tool, the improved prompt was, but tell the truth.
Oh, I love
and
that.
That generated, you know, basically don't make it up or don't infer. It's like it needs to be factual.
For sure. Kareem, can we go for one more? So just a few other hints and tips to think about. Tell it the formatting you want in the output. If you want paragraphs, say so. If you want bullet points, say so. Talk to the prompt about the length of the output that you want. You can also ask your Gen AI for tips on how it could be doing better, right? How can I improve my prompt? Please take that, but expand on point number 3. So you can come back to these as your cheat sheet on how to prompt, but let's do a little bit of a live demonstration. And we're going to do a live demo on ChatGPT as opposed to Copilot, for example. There are lots of good tools out there. There are many that you can get on a free basis. I like to pay for the premium because you get more options. But ChatGPT, in my view, if you want to get creative output, which is what I think it's best for, this is a fun way to do it. I have my HDMI plugged in, but I don't see it coming up. There we go. There we go. So, what are some of the legal adjacent things that I think this can be used really well for? Consider something like an outline. Consider something like a deposition outline. I put together a little blurb here in terms of a prompt that we could type, because you can type your prompt ahead of time. You can make them as long as you want. So here we go. I'm going to set the stage. Who am I? I am a corporate restructuring attorney, and I do a lot of bankruptcy-related litigation. Give it a little more context. I represent a creditor in a major complex Chapter 11 bankruptcy case. One of the critical issues that's currently in dispute is the value of the debtor's business. There are multiple experts with very different opinions on that valuation. I have a deposition coming up of the other side's expert, and I want to be very thorough in my questioning. I'm going to set the stage. I'm going to tell the tool, here's where we're starting. And I'm going to ask it, please create an outline for a deposition of their expert witness on these issues. I'm going to give it 4 different points that I want to make sure are included. I'm going to ask it for that outline with subheadings, with bullet points. Include introductory questions. Tell it I want to be very thorough and detailed. So let's see what's going to happen if we plug this into our tool. All right. Give it a second. It's working its magic. It doesn't take long. Okay. Let's go. Isn't this fantastic? I know. I'm with you. I'm with you, Alex. It's great. It's so great. It's so great. So could I have gone back into my prior expert deposition outlines and dug one out? Yes, I could. But this is a great starting point. Now, am I going to take this outline and just walk into my deposition? No, I am not. But am I going to take this outline, re-review my expert's report, re-review the other expert, sit down with my expert and say, let's talk about what's not in here? For sure. But look at this starting point. How much time did we just save? We have all these different market approaches. Are there others? Yeah, potentially. Oh, still going. It still has more things because I asked it to be very thorough and detailed. Right? So it's still just going. It's my friend. And then at the end, you can also ask it for additional options. You can download it into a Word. This is one example. How are there other ways? Yeah. That's right. For sure. And the purpose of this one is to really demonstrate a use that requires no input of client information, nothing confidential, nothing privileged in here. Will it need to be tweaked for that purpose? Yes, absolutely. But this is just a product that's out there in the marketplace that doesn't implicate any ethical rules in putting together something like this.
Well, now... Melissa's asking a really great question, because if you have an enterprise version of this tool, which is available,
yep,
you just basically feed it those two documentations that you want, and it will completely alter that to exactly a response based on those two documents, because it already understood those documents, and it's grounded in truth based on those two documents. So it's not going to hallucinate outside of that, because you're using RAG, right, retrieval augmented generation, based on what's in those two documents, and based on your prompt, which you asked me, I'm going to ask the questions exactly based on that. So we've used, so CoCounsel, which
CoCounsel
is
we used,
a Thomson Reuters tool, does exactly that. And because CoCounsel gets onboarded as part of your Thomson Reuters rule, it gets onboarded directly to your files, and you can connect it to your clients' files and so forth. So it will do all that work, you know, without having to worry about, you know, confidentiality of the client issues.
And then interestingly,
on the other side of
that,
it's a great way just to do that step of the creative generation as a starting point, knowing that you still need to add your own analysis over top. So let's do another example, because another thing that I really enjoy about this is that you can give it verbal prompts too. It's like sometimes just stream of consciousness is a good thing. I have it on my phone too. Let's see if we can do a demo on this one. Pardon me while I try to talk into the mic and the mic at the same time.
We'll hear you.
I am a partner at a law firm, and I have a client who has been a very loyal client to me for a handful of years. And this client has historically always been a very, very prompt payer. And for some reason, over the last few months, the bills are getting paid later. My partners are starting to get frustrated. They're asking me, when are these receivables going to get paid? And I need to send an email to my client. Please draft three different versions of an email that I can send to my client following up on status of when my bills are going to get paid. I know that they have probably been impacted recently by a lot of financial uncertainty, maybe even the tariff craziness. I want my tone to be warm but professional. I want it to be no more than a paragraph. And again, please provide me with three different options of an email that I can send. That obviously is not real. All of my clients are perfect. Let's see. This is something that I don't want to have to write. I will do anything in the world to avoid having to start typing this email because it doesn't feel good. So how can I use this super helpful tool who wants to help to at least get the first draft done? I mean, these look pretty good. Look at that. A lot of things we're navigating, updates. We know there are broader financial disruptions. I'm not going to copy-paste any one of these, but I sure am going to use those now to get an email out the door a lot faster than I otherwise would. So again, let's be thinking about ways in which we can use these tools to help us create starter dough, to help us do the tasks that we don't want to have to do. And let's look for ways in which we can take the anxiety out of using them when having to think about all of our ethical obligations. Again, using a free tool that implicates no privilege or confidentiality issues. I didn't say who my client is. I didn't get into any details. But there are ways that this stuff can be really, really, really effective and really helpful. And so that's the main takeaway that I want to give to everyone in this room, is think about ways that you can use it that don't have to be scary. And, oh, go ahead, Todd. No, no, no. I was going to turn it over to Kareem to talk about some of the awesomeness that ABI is going to be rolling out. I think these are awesome questions, and I want to come back to them after Kareem has done his presentation, because you and I can spitball on that for probably the next hour and a half. But I want to make sure that we have the opportunity for Kareem to talk about ABI stuff, but I think that the answer is complicated, and we just need to be cognizant of the fact that those changes are going to happen, and we need to embrace it and figure out how we're going to collectively, as an industry, as a profession, acknowledge it and start to think about how we can be doing better to start to train those people up, what that's going to look like, and how our business models might have to change.
So I'm going to – ABI has been doing AI for about 12, 13 years internally. I happen to have – a master's in computer science, specifically in machine learning. So AI was a big thing for me for a very, very long time. Finally, my parents understand what I do, although they still don't, or at least what I studied, because they're like, so you make funny videos, is that, that's what it is? Is that the GPT thing you're talking about? But on a serious note, we've been using AI internally for many, many things that we do on the membership side, on the analysis side, on the without generating content, but definitely on the analytical side of our data set, there's a lot there. So one product that I'm sure everybody here is familiar with was the Rochelle Daily Wire. And I went to Bill Rochelle and I asked him if I can build a model that would emulate Rochelle. The idea of Rochelle picking the best or the most interesting case once a day was very, very intriguing to me. But then I thought, what about if everybody can have Rochelle on the case that they want? What would that look like? So we started working together, building a model. It will come out pretty soon. He's very excited about it. He was very forthcoming with some inputs back and forth on how we approach this and how does it write back the story. So we're not there yet. I can't get the same humor that he provides and his color commentary, but I come close. So I built this before the product that you're going to see. So this is actually using ChatGPT with private GPT Plus. It took maybe two hours to put together, probably less than 2 hours to put together. But to the extent that I kind of want to show what's the power of this tool. So I'm going to be right here. I'm going to drag some files. I'm going to drag this case. So here's the case, if everybody wants to know what I'm doing. I just grabbed this, you know, memorandum opinion of a case from the United States District Court of the Eastern District of Virginia. And I am going to go ahead and go to my RDW, and I say, I said, just summarize this bankruptcy opinion in a bit of Rochelle style. It been trained on how he approaches a case, how he goes through and identify all the nuance. And then that's our version of his colorful commentary, which is like bottom line. And he's been very, very impressed of how little we had to give it information to get back that answer. So the product that we're working on now has the entire corpus of his entire writings, not just that, but also every single panel he's ever been on. So we're training it really to have kind of Rochelle humor, Rochelle analytical analysis of cases, and then we're going to roll that out to members, so the ability for you to drag any opinion in any court case and then kind of get to see what Rochelle's view on that matter is, especially when he does a really great job comparing circuit opinions and where that conflicts will take place. He does a really good job at that, and that's the part that we're really training our AI on. But on that same note, we're about to launch this product in August. This is called InRay. InRay is the largest collection of Chapter 11 court hearings. We have over 15,000 hearings. They represent cases from $50 million and up. We started with New York and Delaware. We moved to Southern District of Texas, and then we've added a bunch of other courts since then. This is just a small sample of collection, but we also decided to add content from all of the ABI conference and events. So every conference, every session, for the last probably 22 years, we have the recording, and we have it all tagged by the professionals, the content, the subject topics, the code and rules, and we did the same thing to the hearing. So it's all available here. This is, like I said, this is just a very small sample that I'm running on a private server. But you can filter by anything you want, court sections, conferences. But I just want to demonstrate what we're talking about. So for this, I'm going to go to my paste here, go to InRay, and I'm going to do, let's see, executory contracts. And I'm going to do search. And what shows up here is the court hearing. This is from the District of Delaware in front of Judge Silverstein. This is the case. We provide the agenda for you, so you don't have to go and dig for it. Right there. Here's the agenda for that hearing. We also provide you with the case website from, so again, if you're looking just for all the dockets on this case, it's right here, hosted by probably the claim agent's website that's available, given the size of the case. So I'm going to pick Boy Scouts. And I looked for executory contracts, and it appears to be here.
Ending. Your Honor's exactly right. You can, you know, executory contracts get rejected. These aren't executory contracts, I think. There are things that can be done with contracts, and so
So now I identified the case that I'm looking for. I want to go through the transcript really quickly by eye, so I launched the transcripts, or I can search directly within that transcript. But as I see the sections that I'm looking for, I come, oh, this is the part that I wanted. I wanted to know about the collateral.
Do you know if any post-fact date payments would be secured by any collateral?
That would be specified as part of that June 15th filing. Joining meeting. And it remains subject to ongoing negotiations.
Now, that's helpful. but we decided to add a little bit more color to it and said, well, how helpful can it really be? I did ask Judge Isger before he left that I'm going to use him as an example, so I want you to know that this was permitted to do so. So I'm going to go ahead and look for midstream, which is a topic that if you do any oil and gas filings, you're familiar with the midstream concept. So here's midstream. This is Lily's Energy in front of the Southern District of Texas, again, in front of Judge Isger. This is an emerging motion to pay royalties. So we'll go ahead and listen in. That audio takes a little longer, but... I promise it'll play. Last time I did this, I wasn't patient enough, and then I realized that it plays eventually. Come on. Please. Yeah, I know. It's just, it's still loading. But so while it's thinking, I'm going to go ahead and start asking questions to that case, right? So I come in here and I made my process simpler so I can come into my INRE and I'm going to say, summarize this hearing and highlight all important parts. So this is live right in front of you. It says, here's the hearing. It's emerging motion to pay royalties, sale motion, important resolution. The judge approved the sale by state over. And then here's the judge approach. Right? I was intrigued by that. There was a point of this when I did it last time. I want to show you that. It did something really interesting to me on that Lily's. It said, this is what it produced to me. I don't know if anybody can see that. But it says, Judge Isger was skeptical of Heritage argument, noting the following, right? So I'm going to do the same thing on this case because I know it's open. And I'm going to come to it knowing that I've heard that, or at least I was told that when I read the transcript. So I'm going to come in here and I'm going to say, can you quote this? I want to demonstrate this is live, right? So you can see as it's happening. So I said, can you please quote Judge Isger's skeptical argument around the unconvertible evidence? And it gave me some quotes from the judge himself on specific issues. So I'm going to find one of those quotes. And I'm going to go back to the case while I'm right here, and that's in Lily's.
Having an evidentiary hearing today, so show me anything in the evidence that says it's not.
I have nothing to show that it's not, Your Honor. I have only the argument that.
No, but they have evidence to show. They have evidence to show that it is. So having a theoretical argument without evidence doesn't get you anywhere under Braniff because I'm not protecting any substantive right.
So right there, live, I'm asking a question. It's giving me a response. It understood there was some sort of a skepticism by the judge. Identified that because there are two pieces of information here. There's the context of the agenda and the text that was provided in the transcript, but there's also a context of the audio. And the difference by doing something like this where we give actually audio, not just the written transcript, but the audio and the implications in the voice and tone, right? We have the ability to identify sentiment analysis of what is actually happening at the court. At what point did the judge seem more argumentative, agreeable, skeptical. That all comes in a tone of voice that you probably wouldn't get from a different, from a simple transcript and word collection. So I'm going to demonstrate another one quickly. I'm going to use the same concept of midstream. I'm going to stick to the midstream because I know I've done that part better. So let's go here. I'm going to do clear all my sections. And we're going to go to this extraction oil and gas. And in here, I set a set of questions. So just so you know, this is a tool I use. It's called Paste. Every time I copy and paste anything, it just keeps it in the bottom for me. It's like my clipboard on steroids. So I'm going to use that same concept, which is summarize the case and the hearing. This is a first day hearing, so it'll have really great input in it. Company background, operation, financial structure, restructuring support, and it goes into details. What's the DIF financing, the key deadlines that was mentioned in this court hearings, right? And some notable items that you need to know. I will continue to ask it another few sets of questions. So my next question will be, what was the capital structure proposed in this hearing? Here it is. It's doing the analysis. It's explaining exactly what was being presented at the court, what was proposed, the restructuring proposal. Okay? I'm going to do the next one, which a very interesting one. What was the USD position in this hearing on this DIP? So I didn't explain what the USD is. It already knows the USD means U.S. trustee. It identified the U.S. trustee in the case, and it talked about what their arguments and what their DIP in that. Then I came in, and I'm actually demonstrate one more thing, if I may. I'm going to go back to the Lilly case. Here's all my questions. They're still there. I'm going to ask the same question. What is the USD position in this hearing? This is the Lilly's hearing. This is the one with Judge Isger was skeptical. I want to show this because it's interesting. You know why it's not hallucinating? Because it could have made something up here. But its answer was very clear, right? After reviewing the transcript carefully, does not appear to have any discussion or position taken by USD trustee during this hearing. The hearing focused primarily on the following. If it was hallucinating, it would have basically told me anything it wanted to do based on the USD position that didn't appear in that case. So we made sure that this is grounded in truth. It will only answer from within this hearing or this case or something bigger, because then you can play with the filters and identify all DIP hearings by the following judge and then ask a question against the judge's rulings. This would become very, very interesting, especially that something that happens in bankruptcy cases a lot is oral decisions don't ever get written anywhere. That way you can have every oral decision that has ever been made within those case filings. This product will come out in August. If you want access to it before then, you won't see me after this because I'm bolting out of here. But email me at the ABI. It's kg@abi.org. Let me know that you want access, and we'll give you access. This product will be very, very affordable. We're thinking anywhere between $50 to $75 a month access to this. You can upload your own content. It will run against it. But also, what I didn't demonstrate is the ability to narrow that context, not just within court hearings, but with also every session that ABI has ever put. So what did Judge Isger say around this topic, you know, not just in his court and which hearing, but also at any of the ABI conferences that he's ever sat on? Thank you.
We're somehow out of time and over time. So this will be not only a thank you to this fantastic panel. Way to go, panel. And happy birthday to Kareem.
Yes.
But also just wanted to take a brief moment overall to close our conference and say thank you.
in particular to our judicial co-chairs, Judge Hannon and Judge Applebaum, who may have already departed, as well as co-chairs Rebecca DeMarb and Phil Groban. Thank you so much. We're so excited to have had this program this week. We hope everyone had some good networking and a chance to enjoy not just this great hotel, but this fantastic city. Thanks again to our sponsors, without whom we couldn't do any of this good stuff. I will get yelled at if I don't remind everyone to complete the survey. To the extent that you have any interest in participating on the advisory board for this conference, you will be getting a thank you email from Julia McNamara of the ABI later on today. And if you just want to respond to her, she'll make sure that the advisory board knows about your interest. We love having fresh voices. This conference has been here in Chicago the last 2 years. We will be back in Grand Geneva next year, June 6th through 8th. We hope that everyone will be there. And after that, we're looking for input from our members, from our attendees. The Midwest is our oyster. So let us be engaged and let people know what you might want to do in terms of where we might be going forward. So thank you again, everyone. Hope you had a great workshop.